committed to diplomacy and is ready to test the path of indirect talks. The top diplomat also touched on the unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. from the nuclear deal. He said Tehran is now ready to pursue talks on its nuclear activities in return for the removal of cruel sanctions against the country as a trust-building step. The commander of Iran's Khatam al-Anbiya Joint Air Defense Command says Iran's air defense systems have been armed with, quote, the most advanced weapons unimaginable to enemies. Brigadier General Amir Sabah Hifard was answering a question on reports on social media that the Islamic Republic has produced plasma guns. The general added that the armed forces have full combat readiness to counter any threat. He warned that any miscalculation by enemies will trigger a decisive response by the Iranian armed forces. This was a response to threats by the U.S. president to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. Sabah Hifard was speaking during a visit to southern Iran alongside the commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Force Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh. During the visit, they inspected the defense capabilities of the forces stationed in southern Iranian islands. Our correspondent in Tehran, Mariam Azarshed, earlier told us the U.S. simply does not have the ability to bomb Iran and wipe out the Islamic Republic.
Nobody really can make Iran do. I mean, for the longest time, we're talking over 46 years, they have tried to annihilate the Islamic Republic, not only, you know, basically bound it to certain boundaries. What the U.S. regime has done is impose extreme sanctions on Iran, impose sanctions on certain medicines that only a few countries in the world used to make, and now Iran is joining those countries. They were killing Iranian patients. Because of what, you know? So obviously, you know, they have done everything in their books, and it hasn't worked with Iran. They haven't been able to make the Islamic Republic bow. And those third parties also, I mean, this is the fact of the matter is those third parties are not exactly independent in their policies. I mean, we just saw recently, military drills Qatar had, for instance, with the Israeli regime as Palestinians are being killed. And at the same time, you know, these, certain Persian Gulf countries, they told Iran that if the U.S. was going to basically dare to bomb Iran, they would actually not allow their soil to be used because these are not really important players. You know, they're afraid. They're afraid if the U.S. hits us because they're afraid that basically American bases in their countries are potential targets for Iran to respond. So really, the only major players in this are Iran and the U.S. And if the U.S. had the power to bomb Iran, it would have already bombed Iran.
The Israeli military presses ahead with its air and artillery strikes across Gaza, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians in its latest round of attacks. At least two people were killed in an Israeli drone strike on a group of farmers in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. Also in Khan Yunis, a Palestinian child was killed in an Israeli bombing targeting tents housing displaced people there. Fatalities were also reported following Israeli artillery shelling of areas in and around the city. Earlier on Sunday, eight members of the same family were killed in an Israeli airstrike in southern Gaza. Other parts of the territory were also the scene of violent regime attacks in the past 24 hours. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, nearly 50,700 Palestinians have been killed since October 2023, when the regime began its genocidal campaign against the blockaded territory, with more than 115,000 others also being injured. Well, now joining us live from Deir al-Balah is our correspondent, Moti Abu Musabih. Moti, I mean, what can we say? Gaza is being used for continuous genocide, for slaughtering, for starvation, and even it's being used as a place to test inhumane weapons. Up till now, we have at least 46 people being killed over the past 24 hours, and now we have reports that Israel is planning to cut off Rafah from the rest of the Gaza Strip by establishing a new military corridor. What details do you have for us on the ground, Moti?
Yeah, as usual, the Israeli coalition forces carried on their brutal and deadly attacks against the Palestinian people, claiming more lives of the Palestinian women and children. And as you have just mentioned, that we are talking about 46 Palestinian civilians that have been slaughtered over the past 24 hours, and this number is still soaring exponentially, having those attacks intensified. Half of those Palestinian casualties were from the southern parts of Gaza Strip, which are still witnessing the cruel Israeli air and artillery strikes. We are talking about constant bombardments are still taking place in those areas. Over the last night, those Israeli explosions have never stopped for a while, targeting the Palestinian people there. The Israeli occupation forces on the ground also pressed ahead towards the western parts of Rafah City. We are talking about dozens of the remaining residential buildings that were completely wiped out after they were detonated by the Israeli occupation forces. And as you know, we are talking about the new corridor, which was taken control by the Israeli occupation forces, which is Mirwaj corridor. And having this corridor under the Israeli control means clearly that the entire city was completely separated and isolated from other parts of Gaza Strip. According to the latest statements of Rafah's mayor there, Ahmed Souf, is saying that 90% of the entire city was completely destroyed as a result of those constant and non-stop Israeli attacks and brutalities maintained against the Palestinian people. And as you know, the Palestinian people there are still beleaguered and besieged inside the western parts of Rafah City. We are talking about at least 500 Palestinian families are still besieged there. They are still under the fire of the Israeli missiles and bombs. They are still deprived of having any access to the basic humanitarian essentials, while the medical teams and the civil defense teams are still unable to reach those areas as a result of the intense and extensive Israeli attacks targeting those areas. The current situation is beyond belief for those Palestinian families there. The current situation is extremely horrific for them. And what is really horrific for the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip is that this nightmare could be reiterated in elsewhere in Gaza Strip, having the Israeli occupation forces, as you know, ongoing with their policy of expanding their genocidal attacks and the ground offensives against elsewhere in Gaza Strip, like what is happening right now in Ashjaya neighborhood, which is also witnessing another ground offensive targeting the Palestinian people there. By the way, this is the fourth time for the Israeli occupation forces to carry out such a wide-scale ground offensive targeting Ashjaya neighborhood. And we understand clearly how the situation would be disastrous for those Palestinian people trapped under the Israeli attacks there, because, you know, the Israeli occupation forces are still intensifying the artillery shelling. We are talking about ceaseless airstrikes. We are talking about heavy gunfire maintained by the Israeli occupation forces. And Palestinian families are still releasing more pleas for the civil defense teams, which are completely feeble and exhausted. They are no longer able to, as you know, to provide any kind of any help for the Palestinian families there, because they are still prevented from reaching those areas, like what happened over the past 12 hours, according to Mr. Mahmoud Bassel, the spokesperson of the Gaza Civil Defense System in Gaza, saying that they are unable to reach the areas of Ashjaya neighborhood because the Israeli occupation forces are still extensively targeting those areas, and they are still preventing the vehicles and the teams from reaching and approaching those areas. So this reveals how catastrophic the situation is for those Palestinian people. And when it comes to the humanitarian situation, as you know, we are talking about an unprecedented situation for the Palestinian people here in Gaza Strip. For more than 37 consecutive days, and Gaza's crossings are completely closed and shut down. This means clearly that the entire population have been completely deprived of having any access to the basic humanitarian essentials and needs. And needless to mention that the Palestinian children are still paying the heavy price of these brutal measures taken against Gaza Strip, according, as you know, to the latest statement of Gaza's health ministry here, that the lives of more than a million Palestinian children are still at stake, because they are still, as you know, they do not have any access to the basic humanitarian essentials, the basic food items, and the drinkable water. In addition to that, recently the Israeli occupation forces are still stymieing and allowing for the polio vaccine to enter into Gaza Strip. And we understand how catastrophic those consequences would be for the Palestinian people. This means clearly that the lives of those Palestinian children in Gaza Strip are still in danger and at stake. So the humanitarian situation is collapsing severely here in Gaza Strip at all levels. Exactly. With all sense of
exactly.
the word.
Exactly. Moti, I'm going to have to cut you off there. Our time has finished, but I definitely will get back to you with the latest developments later on. Thank you very much, Moti Abou Moussabeh, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah. The Palestinian Authority has condemned Israel's deadly attack on a convoy of paramedics in Gaza last month, saying it proves the regime is deliberately targeting the Palestinian territory's healthcare infrastructure. Reacting to a circulating footage of the strike, which took place on March 23rd, the Palestinian Authority said the video is an unrefutable evidence of Israel's brutality in Gaza and blatant violations of the international law. It added the footage reflects the regime's attempt to cover up its ongoing crimes against Palestinians and erase the truth. The footage retrieved from the phone of one of the killed paramedics captures the final moments of the emergency workers that were on a rescue mission in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Their ambulances and fire trucks were clearly marked and had their emergency lights on as they came under fire. At least 15 paramedics were killed in that strike. Well, thousands of protesters have staged a massive rally in the U.S. Capitol against the detention of pro-Palestinian students and scholars in the country in recent months. The protesters gathered in front of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement headquarters in Washington, D.C., calling for the release of the students arrested for supporting Palestinians. They also called for the end of ongoing genocide committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza and the liberation of Palestine. The demonstrators waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans in support of people in Gaza. In recent months, the U.S. administration has launched a campaign of detention of students for their pro-Palestine views. It is looking to deport the students who are legally in the U.S., citing national security. Critics say the move violates free speech protections. Israeli forces are pressing ahead with their raids into occupied Palestinian territories, injuring and abducting residents in the latest round of incursions. At least two people were wounded after Israeli forces opened fire on a group of Palestinians near Wad al-Hummus, northeast of Bethlehem. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers backed by regime forces attacked Palestinian farmers in a village near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. They threw stones at farmers and their vehicles. There were no immediate reports of casualties there. Israeli forces also attacked a Bedouin community near the same village, abducting several residents. Tensions have been high across the occupied West Bank since the regime began its genocidal campaign against Gaza in October 2023. Over 940 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli forces since then. Well, we earlier talked to our correspondent in Ramallah, Naqa' Hamad, to get further details regarding the latest Israeli raids into occupied West Bank towns and refugee camps. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
As you have mentioned, the IOF attacked many areas in the West Bank. Let's start by the news that is saying about targeting of the Palestinian workers near Bethlehem, to the west of Bethlehem, where the IOF opened fire on a group of Palestinian workers who were just trying to go to that place they were. And three of them were injured. Among them is one critical injury that occurred with live ammunition. This is something that we are seeing more, that the IOF attacks Palestinian workers, especially in the areas that are surrounding the apartheid wall, in areas like Bethlehem, in areas like Tarqumia, in Al Khalil, and in areas in the north like Qalqilia, and some parts of Tulkarem. And of course, that was not the only attack that was made by the IOF forces. The IOF has raided both refugee camps of Aqaba al-Jabr and Ain al-Sultan in Jericho and Ariha near to the east of Ramallah. And of course, while making these incursions, many arrests have been made detaining Palestinians, terrorizing families in the hours of the night.
The Yemeni armed forces say they have targeted the U.S. aircraft carrier Harry S. Truman and its accompanying warships in the Red Sea with drones and missiles.
In recent hours, the missile force and drone unit, with support from the naval forces, engaged several U.S. warships in the northern Red Sea, including the U.S. aircraft carrier Truman, using a number of cruise missiles and drones. The hours-long attack operation disrupted the enemy's ability to carry out hostile assaults on our country during the period of the strike. Additionally, the naval forces of the armed forces carried out a military operation targeting the U.S. supply ship accompanying the Truman aircraft carrier with a ballistic missile.
Syria emphasized that Yemen's leadership, people, and armed forces are committed to defending the Palestinian people as a religious, moral, and humanitarian duty. He said operations against Israel and Israel-related ships will continue until the regime's aggression against Gaza ends and the territory's blockade is lifted. Please stay tuned for more updates. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 26, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, In meeting with a number of university students and academic personalities on the 24th day of month of Ramadan. As for the elimination of ideals, it means making individuals indifferent towards poverty, corruption, and discrimination. From the viewpoint of the enemy, there must be a fight against the efforts to destroy these three big devils and evil elements, poverty, corruption, and discrimination. They want to render individuals indifferent towards them. They want individuals to be indifferent towards the domination of Western culture, make them less motivated about standards of the Islamic revolution. Well, the revolution has certain standards which have shaken the whole world and which stimulate resistance in countries. These standards are resistance against corruption and the refusal to give in to bullying and to being blackmailed. These are the standards of the Islamic Revolution. These are the standards of Islamic Iran. These have shaken the world and Islamic countries and have attracted nations to Iran. Whenever our president showed their presence among the people in Islamic countries, despite their various orientations, some of them had completely different political orientations, the people chanted slogans for them and expressed their support. What is the reason for this? Why is the flag of the Islamic Republic raised by other people in different countries, but the flag of the US is burned? These standards have moved the world. Therefore, they want to undermine these standards inside the country and make individuals lose their motivation for them. Other standards include a return to original Islam, the rejection of reactionary attitude, and resistance on the issue of Palestine, which I will discuss at the end of my statements, God willing. So, these are the main concerns. We must have these concerns. Who the people who wish to eliminate identity, the ideals, and independence are, what their number is, and how successful they are, is another issue. This discussion falls on you. You must sit down and discuss and study them in your meetings, but you should know, and you surely know, that such a thing exists. These are the concerns.
Developments and the suspicious death of the Czechoslovak foreign minister Jan Masaryk sends a clear message to the communist opposition. Other Europeans all know that any opposition to Stalin's sphere of influence will eventually result in a Masaryk-style repression. Eastern Europeans are all horrified by Stalin's policies, all but one country, Yugoslavia. Josip Broz Tito, the communist leader of Yugoslavia, came to power on his own and does not need Stalin to stay in power. is a danger to the Soviet government these days. Tito seems to have gotten bored with Stalin's policies due to Common Form's insistence. He has made a serious decision to cut off his country's relations with Moscow. Tito finally does it a year later. Although Stalin's indifference on this issue is a bit mysterious, is there anyone in the Soviet Union who does not know that the incident can send a shockwave through the communist pillars? Stalin has become confused. Moscow has not yet recovered when it was reported that the Soviet leader had taken military action. Berlin, the capital of Germany, was sieged. In a war that took several years, everyone already understood that if neutral Germany gradually tilts toward the Soviets, the Cold War in Europe will be in favor of the communists. But if the opposite happens and Germany moves towards the US, things will get much worse for the Soviet Union. A part of Germany fell into the hands of the Americans that was considered the richest and most developed part of Europe. If the US wants, it can easily turn the region into a powder keg to attack the Soviet Union. Therefore, Stalin should move more cautiously against Germany. Stalin, who thinks the solution is to lay a siege on Berlin, makes the US Army spring into action. They deliver food and other necessities to the besieged city by building an air bridge. Berlin appreciates the move. The Westerners are now a friendly face in the eyes of the German people, as opposed to Stalin, who now has a wild and powerless image in front of the world. The US government gradually takes over the communists. Meanwhile, the Soviet government has no idea that Truman was up in arms to shatter their ideology. In November 1947, a plan was prepared by the Joint Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army called Broiler. The main goal of the plan was to destroy the Soviet Union's ability to wage a war using massive atomic bombardment. The plan considers 34 atomic bombs against 24 Soviet cities at a time the medical reports from the experiments conducted on the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan's atomic bombing are still on Truman's desk. Truman knows very well what consequences await the Soviet Union. However, he prefers to continue sipping his French coffee at his desk and run up and down the report statistics. 2 years later, when over 200 atomic bombs and 20 bombers were prepared for the operation, Truman met with some military experts. They believe that if the U.S. fails to prevent atomic bombing, the bombs may not be effective enough to destroy the Soviet Union's ability to fight. At this time, Truman receives a recommendation from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which makes him think about finding a solution. The Joint Chief of Staff believes the U.S. forces cannot defend Western Europe against the communists, even if they use the atomic bomb. Truman must come up with a proper solution. Broiler's plan fails to achieve the objective. Two years later, it was reported that the Soviet Union had tested its first atomic bomb. American scientists start thinking harder. The issue is slowly turning into an arms race. A little later, a group of American nuclear scientists solved Truman's problem in the major war, a thermonuclear bomb or superbomb. Estimates say the new technology can cause an explosion that no one dares tell Truman about the consequences. The only thing everyone is thinking about now is only one thing: not falling behind the Soviet nuclear industry. In the fall of 1948, Truman begins a new chapter of his negotiations with Western European countries. Western Europe is now ready to cooperate with the White House after the implementation of the Marshall Plan in their countries and receiving economic aid from the U.S. The main objective of discussion in Truman's negotiations with Western European countries is a formal treaty of alliance against communist Soviets. Truman finally forms his international union. NATO is the title the European countries now must line up for membership in. In April 1949, the NATO treaty was signed in Washington by 10 European countries, as well as the U.S. and Canada. The contents of the treaty, which were published, put Stalin in a bind. 1. If one NATO member country is attacked, all members will provide it with military support. 2. NATO members are committed to cooperating in various military fields, including intelligence exchange, military training, and joint exercises. And 3, NATO members should use similar equipment and weapons to facilitate their military cooperation. It is 1955. It's been 2 years since Stalin died. Some news spreads in the world. The news terrifies the Soviet Union. West Germany has joined NATO.
Now we welcome to our company the Federal Republic of Germany, represented here by its great statesman, Dr. Adenauer.
The emergence of a militaristic Germany determined to reunify could be a wake-up call for the Soviet Union that has already been invaded by Germany. During the last days of Stalin's rule, when the political and economic situation in Eastern Europe had deteriorated, his successor, Nikita Khrushchev, must seriously pursue reconstruction and improvement of the situation in Eastern Europe. During these years, East Germany is not doing well. Since 1951, suppression of private businesses by the government, forced membership in collective farms, dissatisfaction with the communist system, and the desire to live in the economic prosperity of the West have driven some East German residents from this region to West Germany. As his first moves, the new Soviet leader resumes ties with Tito. Khrushchev is not happy with Stalin's measures. Yugoslavia resigns the Fraternity Pact with the Soviet Union. But the troubled situation in East Germany and West Germany's accession to NATO will still be big problems for Khrushchev. Khrushchev must find a solution. So he decides to drag 7 Eastern European countries to the Warsaw Pact. Dubbed a military alliance, the treaty commits communist countries of Eastern Europe to help each other in the event of an armed attack by the West. Now Europe is divided into 2 armed groups, the West under NATO and the East under Warsaw.
Following these agreements, Soviet tanks were deployed to East Germany in 1953, Hungary in 1956, and Czechoslovakia in 1968 to crack down on anti-communist movements. Although the evidence suggests that NATO is an alliance of sovereign states, the Warsaw Pact appears to be an imperialist enterprise of puppet regimes under the complete domination of Moscow. Now, Western narratives and propaganda have touched on this fundamental difference. However, while NATO insists on introducing itself as a defense association, everyone gradually gets suspicious due to its actions. In 1960, the U.S. proposes a plan called Multilateral Force. The plan seeks to create a navy consisting of ballistic missile submarines and warships with international crews from NATO member states. Military equipment, all of which are armed with ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads. In 1985, something happens in the Soviet Union which shakes the very foundations of communism. Mikhail Gorbachev becomes the leader of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev's economic reforms gradually drag the Soviet Union into serious economic problems. The severe shortage of food resources turns supporters of communism into vocal dissidents. Gorbachev's slogans take Western shape. Although he commemorates communist leaders, when he leads Soviet Union towards democracy and the free world, he is praised by the Western media. He gets overwhelmed by the Western encouragements. The so-called reforms by Gorbachev not only do not solve the Soviets' problems, but also lead to the collapse and fragmentation of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, with all of its violations and evils, at least its geographical scope, could be a defense barrier against the expansionism of Westerners.
This move was extra-constitutional, outside of the constitutional provisions for governmental change. Clearly, it's a disturbing development, no question about that. And it could have serious consequences for the Soviet society and in Soviet relations with other countries, including the United States.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the U.S. removes its biggest enemy and the Cold War ends. The U.S. government, which promised Gorbachev that NATO will not advance even an inch towards Russia in no time it forgets its promise. The promise is going to get the allies of communism involved. The story now reaches Yugoslavia.
IranRadio.ir. What you just heard was an Arabi English radio program.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brother and sister, salam. So, welcome to a new story. Yes, this is another episode of Lantern, and we have a new story entitled More Generous Than Hatem. Hatem Tai was questioned, "Have you come across anyone more generous than yourself?" He replied, "Yes, I have." He was asked where. He said, "I had been traveling in the desert when I came across a tent. Inside it was an old lady while behind the tent a goat lay tied. When the old lady saw me, she approached me and held the reins of my horse so that I could dismount. A little later, her son arrived and was immensely pleased to have me as their guest. The old lady said to him, 'Commence the preparations for to entertain our guest. Go and slaughter the goat and prepare some food.' The son said, 'First I shall go and collect some firewood.' But the old lady said, 'Going to the desert and bringing the firewood shall consume a lot of time, due to which our guest would have to remain hungry for long, and this would be contrary to social etiquette.' So the son, breaking the only two lances that he possessed, slaughtered the goat, prepared the food, and presented it before me. When I investigated about their condition, I realized that the goat had been their only possession, and despite this, they had slaughtered it for me. I said to the old lady, 'Do you recognize me?' When she replied in the negative, I said, 'I am Hatem Tai. You must come with me to my tribe so that I can entertain you and shower you with gifts and presents.' The old lady said, 'Neither do we seek any reward from our guests, nor do we sell break for money.' And she refused to accept anything from me. Witnessing this generosity, I realized that they were far more generous and munificent than me." Now we'll listen to the explanation of Sister Musavi. She speaks about important points of this story.
أعوذ بالله
الله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from Arab English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about the themes and lessons that we can take out of these stories in our daily lives as Muslims. Well, the story we just listened to is about generosity and its most famous practitioner, who was Hatam al-Ta'i. Generosity, you know, holds a paramount place in Islamic ethics, serving as a manifestation of faith and vital expression of compassion. This principle is beautifully illustrated in the life of figures like Hatam al-Ta'i, who is often celebrated in both Islamic and Arabic literature for his unparalleled generosity. From the Islamic perspective, generosity is not merely an act of giving, it is an embodiment of selflessness, love, and commitment to the welfare of others. The Holy Book of Quran and the teachings of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam emphasize the importance of generosity, illustrating it as a key characteristic of true believer. Hatam al-Ta'i, who is a pre-Islamic Arab known for his extreme benevolence, is often invoked in discussions about generosity. He is reputed to have given away his wealth to strangers and to the needy without a second thought, earning the admiration of many. His story serves as an inspiring example of how generosity transcends wealth. It is about the spirit of giving and the intention behind it. This concept is aligned with the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala commands believers to give generously. One notable verse is found in Surah Al-Baqarah, which states, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة. The example of those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah is like a seed of grain that sprouts into 7 ears. In every ear there are 100 grains. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 261. You see, this verse illustrates that acts of generosity have profound multiplier effects, both spiritually and socially. Okay, well, let's go and have a short break for now, and we will be back very soon.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You are listening to Lantern, and we're all talking about generosity within the characteristic of Hatam al-Ta'i, who was the well-known person for his generosity. Well, the life of Hatam al-Ta'i resonates deeply with the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Imam Ali alayhi as-salam often highlighted the importance of generosity. He stated, "The generous man is he who gives when asked, but the noble man is he who gives without being asked." This distinction underscores that true generosity is not about recognition or reward, but rather about embodying the noble characteristics that elevate an individual's moral standing. Hatam al-Ta'i exemplified this noble spirit, as he would often give to those in need without waiting for a request, reflecting the essence of genuine generosity. In Islam, the notion of generosity is intertwined with the concept of social responsibility. The teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam advocate for a society where individuals care for one another, particularly the less fortunate. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam said, "He who does not care for the welfare of the people is not one of us." This statement emphasizes that true generosity extends beyond personal acts of kindness. You know, it fosters a sense of community and collective responsibility. Finally, the legacy of Hatem al-Ta'i and the teachings of the Islam remind us that acts of generosity can transform lives and create a more just and caring society. Okay, well, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dear brother and sister, thank you very much for your company. This is the end of this episode of Lantern. Until a new story, fi aman Allah.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. Every day we are met with a new heartbreak and horrors, says the engineer from Gaza, Sabreen Shabbat. But we remind ourselves that to remain steadfast because we are Palestinians, she adds. Here is a story of a woman who is keen to speak for all women of Gaza.
Sabreen's story isn't just her own. It is the story of all Palestinian women. Not showing her full identity is her way of telling the world she's a faceless face of all Gazan women who've experienced genocide. It's the story of a thousand like her, family-focused, fierce of spirit, and of intellect. Sabreen may choose to screen her face, but the full glare of her experience living under tyranny has been exposed for all to see. In what has become something of a theme, Gaza's women are some of the most educated, a feat even more impressive for the obstacles endured just to have the right to learn. Sabreen's hard work was paying off. Despite the challenges, she had ambitions to go further, for more. Life in a genocide is a new kind of horror. Survival is simply the beginning of a nightmarish hellscape. The world's failings on Palestine have been noted, most solemnly by the Palestinians who found themselves living under a genocide as life carried on as normal elsewhere. The act of constant displacement, of leaving everything behind in an attempt to escape with your life, takes a heavy toll. The thing they probably don't tell you about living under the shadow of munitions exploding, bodies being broken, a genocide as your shadow, is how your spirit is beaten, even if your body defies the odds and remains intact. The latest round of Israeli aggression has not just robbed Palestinians of the here and now, but by reducing their lives to the most base elements of survival, Palestinians are robbed of a future filled with hopes and dreams. The trauma experienced by those who survived the genocide will require generations to unpack. Mothers, sisters, daughters, sons have all lived through months upon months of a Western-created tragedy one would not wish on their enemies, except perhaps the ones created for political expediency. Sabrine has seen the worst, but strives to live to honor those who are not as fortunate. Sabrine wants us to embrace the things we hold most dear. Create memories. Tomorrow isn't guaranteed, but as long as there's life, there must be hope.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Sabrine's story is Fatima Hilo. She's a British Palestinian filmmaker. Welcome, Fatima. Fatima, this Sabrine talks about the hope and you know, the strength she has, which we've seen in a lot of Palestinians, and to stay steadfast on the path of resistance. But she equates this to her identity as a Palestinian. Now, you as a Palestinian yourself, you know, can you explain this spirit to us?
Well, I share this identity simply because I am also Palestinian, as you've said, and I'm from there. And Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, said, I come from there. I have a home, I have a window, and a prison. So that is, you know, this is the beautiful and the powerful reflection on identity, Palestinian identity, like any other, is a combination of history, culture, traditional, and the shared experience of a people. But what makes it especially striking is that it has continuously threatened by, you know, displacement, occupation, and attempts to erase it. Yet, despite this, Palestinians have held onto their identity with remarkable strength. It is the embroidery, you know, the embroidered dresses, what every stitch tells the story of a village or a city, carrying the heritage of generations. It is the kufiya, not just a scarf, but a symbol of the resistance, which you are talking about, the struggle and the unity.
Do you feel that the fact that, you know, there is this fight for survival specifically?
Definitely.
That is what makes you more strong?
Definitely. Palestinian identity is not just about culture and aggression and you know, expression. Thought it is also deeply tied in the land, to the you know, to the names of villages, the streets, the olive trees, the, you know, the stood fasting, for the centuries, you know, they've been struggling, and you know, this is the oral history passed down from elders who you know, who remember what, you know, once was, and even for those, you know, exile, it carried, you know, in memory, it carried in language, in belonging for the return. The, you know, Sabrine's strengths like that of so many Palestinians comes from this deep rooted identity. It is an identity that has been shaped by the struggle, but also by an unbreakable connection to heritage, to history, and hope. And that's why, no matter, you know, how much hardship they face, Palestinians continue to hold into their traditions, because identity is not just because it's about, you know, past, but also about the future, and the determine of and they determine to protect it.
Absolutely. How much of a faith do you think plays a role here? Because do you think that it is the fact, like, you know, when I struggle to see what is going on in Palestine right now, you know, with the tragedy we see happening, is the way I see it is that, you know, we are all transitional into this world. We only have to think about our role and, you know, what we can do, what are we supposed to do, what really eventually happens and the solution is found, we leave it upon God. You know, do you think this belief in God is probably what also helps in this fighting spirit, in this resilience?
It's more about the strength, you know, like, you know, absolutely, you're right. Sabrine's pain is not just her own. It is reflection of a much, you know, larger struggle, one that history has shown can repeat itself and in if in